traits have made a whole new chapter of history that was unexpected at that time, I think, by just about everyone. Very low interest rates, the lowest rates in four millennia. It looks like we may have turned the corner now, and we've had interest rates going down since 1981 to 2003. Now they're moving up, and maybe we've turned the corner and we're in a period of rising interest rates. So the world today looks at U.S. government debt as a benchmark and the place where, when you're really worried about things, the safe place to put your money is in U.S. government debt. And that's been a very valuable to the United States. The national debt was $1 trillion in 1980, 81, around the time Reagan came in. And, you know, just 10, 12 years ago, it was $10 trillion, and now it's $20 trillion. So the economic base is growing much more slowly now. So unless we find a way of growing somewhat faster, the slow growth of the economy is going to compound the difficulties of handling our national debt. But the politicians have a very short-term view. I think they need to take a longer-term view.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to the summer recess version of the Financial Sense News Hour. John Loeffler here with you. This week on the program, Jim Poplava does an interview with Richard Cilla on the history of interest rates, explaining how money and banking have changed over the last 4,000 years, as far back as the ancient empire of Babylon, all the way to today. And then in the second hour of the program, Kip Anderson on What the Health, probably one of the most controversial documentaries released this year, as they talk about the collusion and corruption in government and big business that costs us trillions of healthcare dollars and actually keeps us sick. All of that coming up today, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's Jim Poplava.
Well, since its original publication in 1963, A History of Interest Rates has become the Bible and authority on interest rates. Originally written by Solomon Brothers partner Sidney Homer, it has been updated by Richard Cilla, who's Professor Emeritus of Economics and former Henry Kaufman Professor of Financial Institutions and Markets at New York University's Stern School of Business. History of Interest Rates is now in its fourth edition. Professor, I'd like to have you describe the world of finance and interest rates today, and if it has changed any since you published your last edition of the book in 2005.
Well, I think that a lot has changed. In fact, unprecedented things have changed. You know, the book covers basically some 4,000 to 5,000 years of interest rate history, more in the recent centuries and decades than before. But I would say that what's happened since the last edition of the book came out in 2005 is that interest rates have made a whole new chapter of history that was unexpected at that time, I think, by just about everyone. Very low interest rates, the lowest rates in four millennia. So I'd say quite a bit has changed. You know, the last 10 years or so, the last 10, 12 years of interest rate history are really unprecedented and quite interesting.
You know, one aspect that really strikes me as I reread the fourth edition again, for 5,000 years of history, interest rates remain within sort of a narrow or close range. They were as high as 20% as described in the book under Hammurabi, and they didn't get there again until 1980 and 81, and then proceeded to get down to 1% last summer and negative rates for many sovereign bonds. We today, when it comes to interest rates, I think who could have ever imagined that we would see during a four-decade period of history unfold the way it did, not only rising to 20% interest rates as we did in the 80-81 period, but also all the way down to 1% negative interest rates as we did last summer.
I think that anyone who's lived through the last 40 or 50 years can consider himself or herself privileged, because you've seen these extreme interest rates of, you know, as you say, 20-21% interest rates back in 1981, and then from 2008 to really up to now, very low interest rates, as you say, you know, close to negative in real terms, or sometimes negative in some places in the world. Someone alive today who remembers the last 40 or 50 years can feel that they've been a part of a special period of interest rate history, from the extreme highs to the extreme lows in U.S. history.
You know, there have been a number of innovations between the third and the fourth edition, and we've seen a number of crises from Japan's bubble, Mexico, Argentina, and finally U.S. What are the risks today, in your opinion, of financial innovation that allows for, let's say, the shadow banking system, which we saw in the last crisis, leveraged through derivatives, unprecedented in anything we've seen before? I mean, originally derivatives came in the 70s as a way to hedge against, let's say, currencies. Now, some of those banks, as we saw during the financial crisis, whether it was credit default swaps with AIG or other institutions, we've never even seen anything like that. What are the risks to the financial institutions with these innovations today?
Well, I think they're not as highly leveraged as they were before the financial crisis. That's the big event of, you know, the financial crisis of, I would call it 2007 to 2009. That's what changed everything. And we know that there was much too much leverage being used before that crisis. Now, there's been a lot of, you know, regulatory reform after the crisis, and the banks have been asked to hold more money. I think you're right, though, that the shadow banking system is still in the shadows to some extent. The regulators are trying to keep track of it a little more. I think leverage levels, while they're not as extreme as they were 10, 12 years ago, are, you know, still pretty high. And we know, some of my colleagues in the economic history business have been writing papers showing that debt levels compared to GDP and so on are at pretty high levels. And that's been a characteristic of this last 40 or 50 years as well. You know, credit's a wonderful thing. The opposite side of it is debt. And, you know, everything's fine, the credit to help build the modern world, but it can be taken to extremes. And, you know, leverage is how you magnify your returns, but they can also magnify your losses. And what we found in 2007-09, that high levels of leverage can cause financial troubles and economic troubles all over the world. So I think the ice we're skating on now isn't quite as thin as it was, say, in 2007, but it's still fairly thin. And so I'm a little wary of the high debt levels. And in China, for example, there's been a really extreme amount of credit creation or debt creation in recent years. And China is kind of a very interesting story of wonderful economic development for the last 30 or 40 years, and they haven't had any sort of major crises, and that's kind of unusual. You know, they're running up their debts to high levels now, and they haven't had a crisis, unlike most other countries that developed in history, so I'm a little wary of what might be going on there.
Let's look at the book itself. Looking historically, as you cover in the book, beginning from time you first look at interest rates, there were two forms of loans back in ancient times, going back to, let's say, 3000 BC. You had loans of grain, which were roughly at 33 1/3%, and 20% loans on silver. How did silver become a medium of credit and eventually money?
Well, I think that silver, you know, it looks nice, and you could make it into nice medallions, and you can make tea cups and other utensils out of it. So it's always been prized, and gold is another one that's been prized. The coins didn't come in until about the 5th or 6th century BC, and they were gold or silver or combinations of gold and silver. But I think it's just because the metal is durable and it has a certain shine. We call them precious metals. Gold, of course, is much more precious than silver. But I think they were always considered to be things that, you know, if you possessed silver or gold, you could always trade it for other things you might need. And one of the great inventions of history was to turn these into uniform coins. And that basically began in one of the Greek provinces, which is then in Asia Minor, or Turkey today, about 500 or 600 years BC. And one of the kings was Croesus, the king of Lydia. And of course, by inventing coinage, Croesus became as rich as Croesus. And so we've had ever since that time, if somebody has a lot of money, we say he's as rich as Croesus. So the innovation of coins was a definite advance in human economic history.
How would you explain that market rates were very stable throughout much of history? It was only during, I guess, maybe the 20th century or modern times that we've seen such wide fluctuations in rates, including recently.
Well, I think we have to look at the underlying monetary system. You know, for the 18th century, the 19th century, even earlier centuries, money was based on precious metals. And we had in the United States, you know, from Hamilton's time to the 1930s, we basically had a silver or gold standard, right? Because we were on silver for a little while in the early 19th century, and then we and the markets altered the sort of ratios of gold and silver, which made gold the preferred base of the monetary system. And the heyday of the classical gold standard was in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But in the 1930s, because of the Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt basically took the U.S. off the gold standard domestically while we maintained an international gold standard. Roosevelt, you know, changed the ratio of gold. The dollar was defined as about 1/20th of an ounce of gold. That was true from Hamilton's time to the 1930s. Roosevelt made it into 1/35th of an ounce of gold, or $35 per ounce for gold. That was a devaluation in the 1930s, but he also nationalized the domestic gold stock. People like my father told me how, you know, there was an executive order in 1933 during the 100 days of the New Deal, basically telling Americans they had to turn in their gold. So we've been on a fiat system in the U.S. since the 1930s, and since the Bretton Woods system, which was the international gold exchange standard from the 1940s to the 1970s, since that broke down in the 1970s, President Nixon followed in Roosevelt's footsteps. Roosevelt took us off the gold standard domestically. Nixon took us off the gold standard internationally. And so we're living in an age of fiat money now. The governments don't have to exchange the paper money they produce for gold and silver anymore. And I think that led to high inflation in the U.S. from the late 1960s into that high interest rate period of 1980-81. And since that time, the central bank's been a little more responsible in not inflating the U.S. currency supply so much. But when you get these, people are not certain of what their money will be worth a few years from now, then they're much more cautious and interest rates can be high. And I would say that the decline in interest rates since 1981 is based on the Fed lost credibility in the late 60s and 70s. It regained it, you know, under Greenspan and then Ben Bernanke and now Janet Yellen. The Fed seems to have inflation under control. In fact, the Fed seems to be worried that our inflation rate is not as high as it ought to be. I don't worry about that so much myself, but I think it's fine that we're only having less than 2% inflation.
Now, interest rates have gone through different changes throughout history, as you describe in the book, from elements of timing, space, quantity, and maturity. What changes, if any, do you foresee in the future?
Well, one of the themes of the book is that based on the past 150 years or so of U.S. history, is that interest rates seem to trend in certain directions for periods of, I would say, from, let's say, 20 to 40 years. So there's like a cycle of interest rates. The trend was down after the U.S. Civil War to about nearly the end of the 19th century, 1898 or so. Then the trend was up for 22 years to about 1920, and then it was down again from 1920 to 1945, then up very sharply in the 1960s and 70s. Interest rates went up to these extreme levels we've already mentioned around 1980-81, and since 1981, they've been trending down. I actually thought when I wrote the fourth edition that the Fed was in a tightening mode in 2004 and 2005, and I looked at how the 10-year bond had reached a low interest rate of about 3.33% in May of 2003, and it moved up fairly sharply as the Fed tightened in 2004 and 2005, and I made a mistake. I sort of said it looks like we may have turned the corner now, and we've had interest rates going down since 1981 to 2003. Now they're moving up, and maybe we've turned the corner and we're in a period of rising interest rates. Well, what neither I nor most people foresaw was that we were going to have this global financial crisis in 2007 and 2009, which forced the central banks to take these unprecedented actions of expanding their balance sheets by factors of 4 and 5. And nobody could have foreseen that in 2004 or 5 when I was doing the last edition of the book. By the way, the publisher asked me if I would be interested in bringing out a new edition of the book, and I said, I think it's too early. We have to see some kind of stabilization of interest rates, and I'd like to see a little bit of an interest rate normalization. I think we're on that path now, but it's going to be a slow path. The outlook from now on, repeating the mistake I made in 2005 5, I think now I might be right in saying the interest rate trend will be up for a while.
Can you explain how credit preceded the coining of money by almost 2,000 years? In other words, before there was money, there was credit.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the discoveries that people have made. Professor Will Getzman at Yale has a book out, I think it's called Money Matters Most or Money is Everything. And he goes into that. The people who study Babylonian seals find that there was an active credit market in Babylon, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, even before coins came in. And, a lot of the seals that survive, in fact, describe credit contracts, loans of one sort or another. As long as you had some commerce, and of course the ancient civilizations of Babylon and of course Greece and Rome, they were commercial civilizations to some extent. And if you have commerce, people are going to want to demand credit, and they did, and even before coins came in.
Now, in your book, you talk about there are four different types of credit, and we see this reflected in the type of credit, or let's say lending instruments out there today. You have long-term productive loan credit. You have short-term working capital. Some of that is reflected in the commercial paper market. You have non-productive consumption loans, think of credit cards, and loans to government, which is sovereign debt. So pretty much those four areas make up our entire credit markets today.
I think that's true. That's probably been true through a lot of history, although the government loan markets probably started in the Italian city-states of the late Middle Ages and Renaissance. A lot of financial innovation took place there. And then in the more recent centuries, governments have borrowed a lot of money typically to finance wars. And so we've had national debts and, of course, in our own country, our capital markets really started under Hamilton when he restructured the debts from the Revolution. There was like a $75 million of debt. That doesn't sound much today, but it was something like 40% of the GDP early in U.S. history. The United States began with a very large debt, and we've, of course, had a very good government bond market ever since the 1790s when Hamilton set the system up. So the world today looks at U.S. government debt as a benchmark and the place where, when you're really worried about things, the safe place to put your money is in U.S. government debt. And that's been a very valuable to the United States. I sometimes think we're abusing the privilege a little bit, but the national debt was $1 trillion in 1980, 81, around the time Reagan came in, and just 10, 12 years ago, it was $10 trillion, and now it's $20 trillion. So that one part of the markets you described, the sovereign debt market of governments, has really expanded a great deal. And I don't know whether most Americans are aware that our national debt has gone up by a factor of 20 since about 1980.
When you look at history as you describe it over the ages in your book, there were two standards of value, grain and silver. Silver was used mainly in towns and grain was used in the country. But from ancient times to the Persian Empire, span of almost 1,000 years, the legislation on credit was remarkably stable. Professor, what accounted for that stability that lasted 1,000 years?
Well, I would have to say as a historian that it may be that the stability is an artifact of the information available. We don't have the sort of information, detailed, granular information on what happened from year to year, decade to decade. When you go back 3,000 years or more, we have a limited set of information, and so it may appear to be more stable than it actually was. Although we know there were trends in interest rates, one of the interesting features of the book is that even in the ancient world, it seems like there was a sort of U-shaped cycle for each civilization. Then the first observations on interest rates show that they were pretty high. You mentioned 20%. Then they might come down to 10% or so in the Babylonian civilization. And then toward the end of that civilization, the interest rates rise. And the same thing seemed to be true of Greece and Rome, this U-shaped pattern. And so bringing that up to the present, we might say that our current low interest rates might indicate that we're at one of the high points of our civilization, and maybe things will get worse from now on. But I think there's some unusual factors. But I would say just, the stability we see in the book that you mentioned might just be based on the fact that we don't have as detailed information for the ancient world as we have for modern times.
Now, during the classical age and the age of Rome, interest rates were fairly stable. I think there was a limit in Rome around 12%, as you talk about in your book. But something also interesting was happening during that classical age. The role of temples is places of safe deposit, and many times they would make loans. Were they really the forerunners of today's banks?
Well, they may have been to some extent if they made loans. I think the Romans had some vestiges of banking and commercial credit, but these temples were important, and they've carried on even into medieval times. There were temples there. Of course, the Knights Templar were people who had a lot of money and became early bankers until somehow the Pope and other authorities cracked down on them. But modern banking probably began more in those Italian city-states, you know, Venice, of about a, you know, roughly 1,000, maybe a little less than 1,000 years ago. That's when we see the emergence of something that looked like modern banking. And in fact, you may be interested to know, if you didn't know it, that the word bank comes from the Italian word banco, which meant like a little table or a bench. And the first bankers would spread out this little table or bench and open up their account books, you know, and have assets on one side and liabilities on another. And so they were, some people were putting money with the bankers and, you know, at one interest rate, and the bankers would then lend it out at a higher interest rate. And because the main symbol of their business was the banco or bench, they got to be known as banchieres in Italy and banquiers in France and banks in the English-speaking and German world. So that's when really modern banking began. But I think those temples were maybe forerunners of modern banking.
I want to move on to the Dark Middle Ages. For various religious reasons, there was a prohibition in many ways against interest as a form of usury. Christians were forbidden, but Jews were allowed to take interest from foreigners. During this period, you had the emergence of people like loan sharks and pawnbrokers. Explain what was going on there, because it was considered unchristian-like to charge somebody interest.
Yeah, I think the Catholic Church sort of viewed charging someone interest on a loan was a way of kind of exploiting them. You know, the idea was more on the consumer loans. You know, we talked about productive loans before and consumer loans. The Catholic Church thought that, you know, people in distress would need to borrow money, and the people who had money to lend them would charge them high rates, and somehow that was unchristian or immoral. So, you know, it goes back to Aristotle, the Greek philosopher who wrote on so many different topics. He himself thought that money was barren and that people shouldn't charge interest on it. But I think the main reason was we were talking about consumer loans and people in distress, and it was thought charging them an interest rate when they were in distress and maybe needed to borrow to maintain their lives. The notion was that people could be exploited, so the church said that you shouldn't do that. And, you know, there are still usury laws, I think, in some places. But I think we've gradually gotten to realize that it can be productive if somebody lends you money for entrepreneurial reasons to build a business. That can be a useful thing in society. So we've gotten away a little bit from the notion of usury laws, but I think there's still some vestiges of them around. I think credit card rates could be regulated. You know, one of the reasons 30 or 40 years ago Citibank moved to South Dakota, as the South Dakota legislature allowed Citibank to charge on its credit cards whatever they wanted to, where there were lower limits on what they could do if they issued them from New York. So Citibank moved its credit card operation to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, made it into a minor financial center just because they could get away from usury ceilings that they faced in New York.
Now, eventually, the church changed its views. What led to the modification of the church doctrine? And also explain the role of annuities in the Middle Ages. A lot of towns issued annuities in payments to individuals. I didn't realize, and I forgot about that when I reread the book, about the role of annuities in the Middle Ages as a form of credit and financing.
Well, I think on the first question, the church changed its view because it began to learn from bankers and merchants that credit was useful to an economy, and therefore that you shouldn't have such a negative view of it. You know, the negative view came from thinking that all loans were consumer loans and a way of exploiting people's misfortunes. You know, if you didn't have any food to eat and you wanted to borrow some money, well, you were in a vulnerable position. The church didn't want you to be exploited. So that's where the usury laws came from. But over time, they learned that credit could be a productive part of a functioning economy, and so the church backed off a little bit from the extreme form of that. And in between, the merchants found ways of hiding the interest they were charging by claiming, you know, this was an exchange rate for converting one money into another. Usually that exchange rate had some interest in it too, but it didn't seem to violate the church doctrine.
Basically, the change of how this doctrine of usury, gradually the church kind of relented a little bit on it, and we now saw credit. You saw it, for example, with the banking families, with the Medici, and in the 14th century.
Yeah, the Medici were among the bankers who, you know, got around the usury ceilings that the church had in their time. By the Medici Bank was an international bank. You know, it had branches in different places in Italy, and Italy was not a unified country then, so the different places in Italy may have been in different sovereignties, and they also had banks in Belgium, and maybe even in some of their bankers got into England. And so they handled a lot of international transactions, and they could usually disguise the interest rate as an exchange rate between money. And I think the church allowed that, you know, that maybe the bankers persuaded the church that it should allow that. But eventually the church, you know, just didn't get so excited about usury. So that's the way the usury things went down. I think in the modern world, we discovered that credit can be productive.
I want to move forward to England and the political revolution of 1688, how that transformed financially as well as not only politically, but also the country with the establishment of the Bank of England.
Yeah, that was in 1694. I think, you know, as a prelude to that, we have to go back and look at the innovations of the Dutch nearly a century earlier. The Dutch had financial historians, some of us call a financial revolution, which basically means you put in a lot of the aspects of modern finance in a relatively brief period of time. So around 1600 or so, the Dutch actually started government bond markets. They started equity markets, the Amsterdam Bourse, you know, one of the first stock exchanges, I think, came up in 1609. The Dutch East India Company issued the first equity shares around that same period. The Bank of Amsterdam was founded at that time as a kind of something like a central bank. And so the Dutch had a lot of financial innovation, and they parlayed that into the Dutch Golden Age. By the middle of the 17th century, the Dutch were, you know, the most developed economy in the world. And, you know, I spent 25 years at NYU in New York, and New York was called New Amsterdam because it was the Dutch, when they were the big boys on the block, that established the colony of New Amsterdam, later taken over by the English. The English spent much of the 17th century being jealous of the Dutch. And the revolution of 1688, the Glorious Revolution, actually brought the Dutch leader, Willem of Orange, over to England to become King William III of England. And he brought the Dutch financial experts with him, and they proceeded along with the English to have a financial revolution in England. They established the government bond market, and they established the Bank of England, as you mentioned. And there were already some bankers, you know, London private bankers, but they became much bigger during this financial revolution. So you had, you know, the government debt market, the central bank, Sir Isaac Newton and others helped stabilize the British pound into a solid metallic-based currency. You had the development of the banking system in Britain, and mostly in the 18th century. And you had the development of securities markets and even a number of corporations like the East India Company, and the Bank of England, of course, was a corporation. So that's what we mean by a financial revolution. And that basically took place in the early decades of the 18th century and made England into the next country after the Dutch to become the dominant economic power. And I would say, based on my studies of U.S. history, that we're quite fortunate that Alexander Hamilton knew that Dutch and English financial history, and he himself said that the United States has to have these modern institutions of credit. And he perhaps created the quickest, neatest financial revolution of all while he was Secretary of the Treasury, you know, establishing the government bond market, the Bank of the United States, the dollar based on gold and silver. And the states then chartered a lot of state banks, and we have the securities markets, and the New York Stock Exchange traces its origin to the Buttonwood Agreement of 1792, right in the middle of Hamilton's administration. And a lot more corporations came in at that time.
Let's talk about the creation of Bank of England, and with the creation of the first central bank, how did that change the credit markets and interest rates, where you now had the creation of these national super banks with a lot of countries following that? As you just mentioned, Hamilton was aware of it, and he tried to establish a central bank here during his administration.
Yeah, well, he actually did. I mean, he established the Bank of the United States. But unlike the Bank of England, you know, which was founded in 1694, and it had to get its charter renewed at various times, and it was successful in doing that. The United States was a little different. Hamilton's bank was chartered for 20 years, and in 1811, Congress, by one vote, the vice president had to break a tie vote in the Senate. They did not recharter the Bank of the United States. Then we had the War of 1812, and everyone said, gee, we would have been much better off financially if we'd had the Bank of the United States during the War of 1812. So in 1816, we chartered a second Bank of the United States, and it did a pretty good job, especially in the 1820s and early 1830s. But Andrew Jackson didn't like it, and so he vetoed the recharter of that. So the U.S. then was without a central bank from 1836 until the Federal Reserve came in 1913. So we have a kind of interesting checkered banking history. It's my opinion as an economic historian that the two banks of the United States early in our history were very effective central banks and economic institutions, but they had political problems. And today, again, we see that the Federal Reserve seems to be doing a pretty good job economically, but it's under a lot of political attack from people like Ron Paul and Rand Paul, and you know, other people seem to be suspicious of the, you know, there's a whole bunch of people who are critics of the Federal Reserve now and think it's doing terrible things and ought to be reined in or reformed in some way.
Yeah, because as you talk about in the book, there was a great opposition with Jackson against it. And it wasn't until, 1913 that we got the Federal Reserve. And we had the panic of 1907 and the famous story of J.P. Morgan locking up the bankers in a room until they could figure out a way out of the crisis of 1907. Today, the Fed has been heralded for saving the economy after the financial crisis, but now it is coming under a lot of criticism for keeping interest rates too low. So it's an institution that politically has to navigate and walk a narrow path between both parties, because they can become the whipping boy depending on who's in office.
Oh, that's right. I think in the run-up to the elections in 2016, I think Donald Trump said that, you know, he thought the Federal Reserve was keeping interest rates too low in order to help Hillary Clinton win the election. And so that's the idea of the, you know, somebody's going to say that the Federal Reserve is favoring one political faction or another. Donald Trump also said he liked low interest rates. And I guess once he was elected, he said he hoped the Fed would keep them low. He hasn't said too much about the Federal Reserve since that time, and he has some appointments to make. But I think, you know, the Federal Reserve, as you mentioned, does have to be a sort of political institution. In order to carry out its economic functions, it has to make sure that it doesn't step on too many political toes, because Congress created the Federal Reserve, and Congress could, you know, alter the Federal Reserve as it kind of did in the 1930s, or it could even take the Federal Reserve away. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but there are people who, you know, would like to get rid of the Federal Reserve, and some of them are politicians today.
You know, one of the things that we've seen is the credit markets change, as you document in your book, and the creation of central banks, which can regulate credit in markets. In your view, why was the 20th century been so inflationary, while the 21st century has been more deflationary?
Interesting question. I would say that I touched on it earlier, I think, when I said we detached our money from precious metals. We may have done that for good reasons. I think the modern economies have become so large that it's not so easy to base money on something like gold, which is, we find gold, but it's hard to find and it's expensive. I would say the main problem with having a gold standard system basing money on gold is that it's a very expensive system. In principle, fiat money works pretty well as long as you don't have too much of it, and it's much cheaper. You know, if we went back to the gold standard, we'd have to send a lot of more people to mine gold to support money in today's greatly enlarged economies. But, you know, having studied the 19th century when we were on a specie standard, silver or gold, and the 20th century, basically the 19th century was a century of zero inflation. That is, prices in 1914, at the end of the long 19th century before World War I, were not very different from where they were in 1800 or 1815. And one virtue of the gold standard or metallic money standards is that they seem to maintain a stable price level over the long run, even though you could have fluctuations. You know, when gold was discovered in California, there was inflation in the 1850s. But you get long-run stability. The 20th century, when we've shifted to fiat money, was like 3% inflation century overall. Of course, we had World War I, World War II, price level about doubled in both of those wars. The interesting thing about more recent history in our lifetimes is that we had that great inflation of the late 1960s and 70s. Well, I shouldn't say it was peacetime because we had the war in Vietnam, but that was a small war compared to World War I, World War II. The interesting thing about that period was that in relatively peaceful times, we had a lot of inflation. That was unusual in U.S. history. And I think we learned from, you know, the Federal Reserve was culpable in that. And that may be one reason why politicians can be negative about the Federal Reserve. They can remember when the Federal Reserve did cause a lot of inflation. And the Federal Reserve, of course, knows that too, so it doesn't want to do that again.
You know, given the events of the financial crisis between 2007 and 2009, and today's historical low interest rates and the massive amounts of debt, both at corporate, government, individual level, you know, people, as you mentioned, we had $1 trillion in debt when Reagan stepped into office, and over the next 20 years, it went up tenfold. The thing that really surprised me, President Bush took office in 2001, the debt was $5 trillion, he doubled it to 10, Barack Obama took office, and he doubled it to 20.
Right.
What is the most likely path going forward from here, if you were to look and peer into the future?
Well, I think people are aware that we have run up these debts to very high levels and we may have some trouble paying them. You know, if we sort of believe, as I said earlier, that we're probably in a path of rising interest rates now, or you know, the Federal Reserve is talking about normalizing rates. And as these rates go up, of course, the government is going to have to pay more money to finance its debt, and that has implications for the budgets. And beyond the actual national debt of $20 trillion or so, there's the Social Security system, which the trustees of it say is going to, you know, start having a deficit in a few years. And then we've got the Medicare system, Medicare, Medicaid, that apparently they're paying out more money than they're taking in. And so we have, beyond the national debt itself, we have the unfunded liabilities of Social Security coming up, and we have unfunded liabilities for Medicare coming up. So I think we need to face these issues. Some people like Pete Peterson have been focusing on that, saying we need to become more fiscally responsible. And I sort of believe that, but other people say, well, it's not something we have to worry about right now. I kind of think we do have to face up to some of these debt problems. And, you know, we've been lucky with these low interest rates that the rise in the national debt, I would say the history of financial crises show that government debts do rise a lot in the wake of major financial crises. So that experience was not so unusual, and it was due to a weak economy partly. But I think we continue to have an economy that's, you know, while growing ever since 2009, it's only growing at around 2%. And, you know, in the 19th century, it was more like 4 to 5%. And throughout the 20th century, it was more like 3 to 3.5%. So basically, these debts have to be paid out of the economic base, and the economic base is growing much more slowly now. So that's, unless we find a way of growing somewhat faster, the slow growth of the economy is going to compound the difficulties of handling our national debt and the unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare. So I would like to see more of our leaders facing up to these issues, but the politicians have a very short-term view. I think they need to take a longer-term view.
Professor, you mentioned that they've asked you to consider writing a fifth edition. Peering into the future once again, if you were to write the fifth edition, what new things would you add to the book?
There are many discussions of Federal Reserve policy in the book over the 20th century and into the 21st century. But the policies of since the financial crisis have been most unusual. In, you know, the Federal Reserve expanded its balance sheet so much, and the European Central Bank, the Japanese Central Bank have done the same thing. The Bank of England has done that. And so I think there'd have to be a discussion of why these policies, which gave us our low interest rates, why they didn't cause more inflation. That, to me, is one of the interesting questions. You know, many people said ever since the Fed began to expand so balance sheet so rapidly and starting in 2007, and it really, you know, it was less than a $1 trillion balance sheet then, and lately it's been more like $4.5 trillion, so it's been like a fivefold increase in the balance sheet. Well, you know, if the central bank creates more credit, you would think that we might have had more inflation, but we didn't. Why not? Well, one of the reasons is that, you know, the Federal Reserve bought all kinds of treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities, and that created a lot of what we call high-powered money, you know, bank reserves, but the banks didn't lend it out so much. So we can sort of say that the banks have all these excess reserves now, I think, in the couple of $1 trillion of excess reserves that they don't really need, but they've been reluctant to lend it out. And I think that's because of some uncertainties in the economy. Maybe it's because of the slow growth. Maybe it's because the aftermath of the financial crisis tightened up financial regulations. But I think we have to see how that plays out. I sort of wonder myself why the banks aren't out, you know, making more loans. And if they do that, then all the Federal Reserve credit that's been created in the last 10 years could become inflationary. And I think that's why the Federal Reserve is talking about normalizing interest rates now and letting them go up. And they're also talking about shrinking their balance sheet.
Well, Professor, I look forward to reading your fifth edition of the book. I just recently reread your fourth edition. And the thing that really struck me as I was reading it for the second time is this really unprecedented period that at least I've lived in my lifetime, seeing interest rates rise to 20-21% back in 1980 and 81, almost all the way back to the rates at Hammurabi's time to recently as last summer, when rates got down to almost a little over 1.3% here, and almost a third of a sovereign's short-term debt was negative, certainly an unprecedented period of time that we've been witness to.
Yes, I think we've lived through an unusual period of interest rate history. I'm not sure most people are aware of it, but anyone who's, say, 50 years old or more has lived through a sort of unprecedented cycle of interest rate history. And I think we should hope now that we can get back to a more normal situation. You know, one of the times when interest rates normalized was they were quite low after World War II because the Federal Reserve basically was under the thumb of the U.S. Treasury, which wanted low interest rates. And starting in the late 1940s and especially in the 1950s, interest rates normalized and they went up from, you know, 2.5% to 4-4.5%. And that was one of the best economic decades in our history, the 1950s. So we don't have to worry about normalizing interest rates as harming the economy as long as it's done in an orderly way. So maybe, you know, the outlook isn't so bad if we normalize interest rates and the economy keeps growing. I think that we would get back to more normal times instead of the interesting times we've had for the last 40 years or so.
Well, Professor, I want to thank you for joining us here on our show. And I can't tell you how much wisdom both you and the former Sidney Homer have put into this book, because it is, I consider, one of the most definitive books on interest rates out there. I want to thank you for joining us on the program, and I look forward to your next edition.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Jim, and I'm not sure that I'll have time to write the next edition, but maybe somebody will. You know, I picked up from where Homer left off, and maybe somebody will pick up from where I left off. But I think it's a bit early to do it now because I'd like to see a little more normalization. I don't want to make the same mistake I made in 2005, saying that we hit a low of interest rates in 2003.
Okay. Well, listen, Professor, all the best to you. Have a great rest of the summer, and thanks for joining us on the program.
It's been my pleasure, Jim.
And a final thought that really struck me, and I was glad to hear the professor echo my very same views, and we've talked about this on the program, is if you're in your 50s or 60s today, you truly have lived in a historical time in interest rates, a time where we saw interest rates reach the high of 20% in 1981, something they hadn't done for 5,000 years. You'd have to go back to Hammurabi in 3000 BC when interest rates were typically 20%, and likewise last summer when they got down to 1.3, and almost one-third of sovereign debt around the world was negative. And as he said, he wasn't quite sure about writing the next edition because he'd like to see some kind of stability return before we would be on a normal path that he could write about innovations. So it may be we're still in this cycle of lower interest rates that began in 1981, but it is one of the most definitive books out there. And if you really want to understand the credit markets, interest rates, and how they've developed over the years, there's no other book that is good as this one. It's in the fourth edition. It's called A History of Interest Rates by Sidney Homer and Richard Silla, who's been my guest today.
Coming up on the next part of the Financial Sense News Hour, Jim Poplava interviews Kip Anderson. What the health? What is it that the government and big business are doing, costing us trillions of healthcare dollars every year, but actually keeping us sick? It's going to be an interesting, if not a little controversial, conversation coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.